why is the world designed the way it is? Who did that? Even our building codes and things like that. Why did that, does that code exist? You know, those are important questions to ask. And then understand that you have the power to change that. It's all, you know, unwritten and can be designed a certain way. It's just like these series of little problems. They're all solvable. And it's incumbent upon us as designers. We create the world that we're all living in and sharing. It's a small percentage of us that do this. And we're basically making the future every building that lasts 25, 40, 50 years at a time, you know, and an environment and products and everything else. So it's incumbent upon us to do it well and for everyone.
Hey there, it's Angela, and I'm so glad you found your way here to architecting. Creative careers can be stressful, and it's hard to be vulnerable, but this is your landing pad for raw honesty. I'll help you get clarity, reconnect with your passion, and have the career of your dreams. If you're ready to make a difference, have an impact, and say bye-bye to burnout, stick with me, and let's get architecting. Bright Lights, it's Angela, and welcome back to Architecting. I am super pumped today to have with me my colleague, fellow healthcare architect, Noam Platt. Hey, Noam.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So I know you through the American College of Healthcare Architects. We're both certified healthcare architects, and we've worked together on some initiatives through there. And I've been impressed with your passion, but it's not just a healthcare architect. You are also the founder of a nonprofit called Make Good, which specializes in creating assistive devices for people with various physical needs to help them have more quality of life. Architecting gives a portion of the proceeds to charity every year. So you were the charity for this year, and hopefully we can give you an even bigger donation next year. But you've also had a really varied career. You've been a regulator for Washington State, even though you're based in Louisiana. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what led you to wanting to be an architect, then a healthcare architect, and all the other stuff that you're doing.
Well, thank you. And thank you again for the donation. So I'll tell my architecture origin story, you know, how I ended up even in architecture school. And it's unlike, I think, what a lot of people think. It's not something I knew as a little kid I wanted to do. I was sitting with my dad at the kitchen table, and he was going through the book of majors from Louisiana State University, where I went to school, accounting, anthropology. And when he got to architecture, I was so just annoyed by having to sit here and do this. I just said, let's do that. It sounds great. Really not having a full conception of what that even was. And even though I knew a couple architects, you know, as a kid growing up, so I didn't come to this as like being artistic or having this, you know, predisposition or anything. It was, I feel like I learned everything in design school and in practice as well. So, you know, I did a 5-year program at Louisiana State University, in which at the end of that, me and a few students undertook a medical project for the local medical school where my dad was working. So one of his colleagues came to me and said, we need a surgical skill lab designed so we can raise money to then build it out. So they needed some renderings and some plans and kind of some of that, you know, work that happens before a real project happens. And so at LSU, they found Rick Lipscomb, one of our fellow ACHA certificate holders, to teach us for 3 semesters. To teach us in healthcare design. So that's how I really got into the field of healthcare design through architecture school. So we're very lucky to be undergrad students learning about the FGI guidelines and working. And our class was in Rick's office at WHLC in Baton Rouge, where, you know, LSU is. So we were very privileged. And all 3 of us who completed that course are working in various healthcare planning or project roles, you know, all over the place, in different parts of the country. I was very lucky to have that experience, and that really set me up for a career staying in healthcare architecture.
You haven't just worked on healthcare designs, though. You've managed to bring this interest in technology to what you're doing, including now branching out into AI. How do you put those 2 things together?
It took me many years working in the profession to even see some of the bigger issues that happen in multiple workplaces across multiple projects. And especially when I worked as a regulator and worked with, dozens of teams all over the state and all over the country who were designing projects in Washington State, even though they're based in Texas and wherever. A lot of the issues in just keeping the information categorized correctly. Like many architects, we learn to use technology to do our jobs, but ultimately there's a lot of issues, and I don't really want to get so far into, why Revit is the way it is and all this sort of stuff. But anything that helps us express ourselves and allows us to communicate better is really what I'm interested in. I think a lot of where the AI is now, just to give a quick brief on what I've been hearing and talking to people about, we can try to generate imagery basically to make books, right? And that's kind of what I think about what architects do. If you boil it down to the simplest problem, we make books. It's kind of the thing. There's a lot behind that, but ultimately that's what sits on the
Never
table.
thought of it that way, but that's an interesting way to frame a set of drawings.
Yeah, stuff that's generating imagery to match that book using the system that we have. We don't have to make books. There's other ways to do what we do, but our whole system is set up to do this. So AI to solve that problem doesn't quite understand, I think, what the actual environments are. So I think that's where it's going to go. And then, more than just using AI to make money, which is to say expedite that process, how do we use AI to actually understand what we're building and why, what we should be building, what can be repurposed, kind of these kind of larger questions, I think is very much more interesting than the like, how do we just streamline the 6-month construction document process or whatever. I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of data we need to even do that. So I'm doing a series of interviews right now with people from companies like TestFit and Swap, which is a big AI company out of Israel that does this stuff, to really see what they see for the future as well. So it's our responsibility to be on top of this stuff and to use it responsibly.
Yeah, it's really a paradigm shift. And I think sometimes we get in our own way because we're like, this is the process and we can't change it. But we actually, I think, as you're beginning to uncover, we're holding ourselves back as a profession by not questioning some of this process.
Yes. And we're just seeing the first generation of software tools for architects, things like TestFit and UpCodes, right? These are not complicated softwares. They should have existed, the next generation to then really understand how to solve, the problems that the way we think about them is very exciting.
Yeah, and I think without needing to know anything about those softwares, I just think what you're really driving at is we need tools that are intuitive to use that let us explore more scenarios and ask what if more often, not just apply what we know works.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think even, the AHJs are now realizing that they need to move their processes forward and also understand how we're using some of these tools as well throughout the process. So I think that collaboration is going to be key.
It's an interesting intersection with the make good work because it asks that critical question of how are our buildings failing people?
It's all about just distilling this kind of like extremely simple issue. Kind of ties together all of like you said, my doing my regulation work and make good is trying to find that singular problem that has to be solved. That's usually very simple to solve. It's just hard to uncover what it actually is. In make good, it could be something like a seatbelt buckle holder for somebody who uses a wheelchair so they can dock their seatbelt while they transfer in and out. This solves a huge problem. And you can't get something like this. And it's this little small intervention. I read a study recently about falls and about the bed height in hospitals being adjusted by somebody drawing blood and they don't adjust it back to the right height. So people get out of bed in the morning, they fall. And this is like this extremely simple design intervention, put a piece of tape or whatever it is to mark where it should be, that solves a huge problem. I think this is what we do as architects. We're solving like big groups of these huge problems together. And most issues can be really found that really simple solution. I think that's what's really great about this profession. And those are skills that you build doing that kind of work as an architect and, designing hospitals and reviewing drawings and learning about the code and all that. And that could apply to lots of different areas in life if you want to branch out into product design, advertise, like whatever your other thing might be, or if you have something else that interests you later, the skills you're building are second to none, frankly. I think it's the only reason I'm successful with my work at Makegood is because I was a healthcare architect. It uses the same set of interpersonal skills to work with a variety of people who communicate in a myriad of ways, and getting everybody to understand and provide their input and help lead and all these other things. So, I'm a big advocate of people, obviously, going into our profession for these reasons. And
So, how did you get into making things for people to help them do the tasks of life or hobbies that they enjoyed that their physical abilities no longer let them do?
or many people, as they sit presently, know somebody who is disabled or they're disabled themselves, but everybody will eventually be disabled as well. And I worked at a summer camp for disabled kids, and I, a cousin who I help with, a good friend of mine as well. Growing up, I was exposed to this. And then I had a different cousin actually start an organization that does this kind of work, over a decade ago, and got involved with that a little bit. And then it took many, many years that I did a couple of events. And then somebody locally in New Orleans asked me for something to help design a chair. So that's really how it started and really how we keep on going. People really just ask us for things they already know they need. They already have designed most of the things that they come to us with. They need help, refining it and doing all those other things and prototyping it and making sure it works. It's really one of these things that once you see the demand and need out there, it's very hard to ignore. And these simple things in life that many of us take for granted, like tying your shoes, is very difficult. It uses a lot of fine motor and cognitive skills to do and undo your laces as well. We're working on a project around that, and hopefully releasing a product soon using a can of hairspray. I could go into dozens of different things that are just very difficult if you don't have, full mobility in all of your limbs. Once you start viewing the world like that and really questioning, why is it this shape? Why is it so hard to do that? And then there's the obvious stuff, like we went to a TV station to do an interview. We have Philip Dunham on Makegood staff. He's a great friend of mine and a manual wheelchair user. And they had a 2-inch or 1.5-inch lip to get into their studio, and we had to help him over. And you can actually 3D print a little ramp and put one there. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to do that and kind of make it a new story. We'll see if they go for it. But once again, it's just like these series of little problems. They're all solvable, and it's incumbent upon us as designers. We create the world that we're all living in and sharing. It's a small percentage of us that do this. And we're basically making the future every building that lasts 25, 40, 50 years at a time, and an environment and products and everything else. So it's incumbent upon us to do it well and for everyone. Universal design works better for everybody. I was just looking on LinkedIn at my friend. He has a ceramic mug, which I unfortunately don't have with me. That's just designed for people with limb difference or who have really, have arthritis. And it's just a few simple changes in the handle. It's a wider shape and it's kind of this and that. And it works amazing for everybody. He looked at a coffee cup and was like, why do all the handles suck? For everybody, they're all terrible. Like the coffee cups you buy everywhere. And so he redesigned it, and he just launched on Amazon, CURVD, Curve, and it's a great mug. I use it, pretty regularly. It does just work better. So he has that same sort of curiosity. When I teach students and to the listeners out there, this is what I hope to be unlocking, is this just like base primal kind of curiosity about like, why is the world designed the way it is? Who did that? Even our building codes and things like that. Why did that? Does that code exist? Those are important questions to ask. And then understand that you have the power to change that. It's all, unwritten and can be designed a certain way. So, through lots of failure, obviously, and iterations, I mean, it's like the whole thing is just making stuff that doesn't work. But I really view it as a big experiment. It's kind of with our buildings, they're experiments as well. And the stuff I'm making with Makegood, that keeps it, that kind of inquisitive nature going and frees us up as an organization to try unconventional things as well.
Well, I really want to celebrate your courage because a lot of people don't question so much in their life. And your willingness to say yes, your willingness to try things is really, I think, what is leading you to more and more opportunities and really helping a lot of people. Even when you were saying you first were exposed to healthcare architecture, doing a favor for your dad, a lot of people would say, I can't do that. I'm not an expert. But you didn't say that. And I really want to highlight that, because that kind of growth mindset, that willingness to try, it's not coming from a place of ego. You're not like, yeah, I could do anything. It's saying, I'll bring what I know to the problem and help as best I can. But just that willingness to do it makes such a difference.
Absolutely. And I mean, I didn't, in that situation, you know, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, frankly. But most of my peers said no. The class was open to anybody, and we had 5 people the first semester and 3 finished. So, you know, many people thought it was boring or uninteresting, and I didn't know how to advocate for it because I was also new. But yeah, I think it's important to just try things that you have no idea how to do. I try to do it all the time. I also want people to understand I'm not this like super crazy hard worker up on, like, I'm pretty lazy. You know, I'm pretty average, really, in most respects, you know, so it's not something that it takes a ton of time or effort to do some of this stuff either. Just about applying the skills you have and building those skills and working with people and using partners and stuff. I hope everyone wants to get involved, because there are opportunities, especially with assistive technology, for everybody. If you're a designer, if you are just interested, or you know somebody who is disabled, or you or yourself, there's like tons of opportunities with organizations like Make Good, Makers Making Change, and Tikkun Olam Makers. These are all public organizations you can sign up for that have stuff you can make, and there's requests out there for people who need stuff as well. And I always encourage people to just try to, you know, create something, whether that's with a friend who is a craftsman, or you want to get a 3D printer. It's really easy to do these days. They're relatively inexpensive and they work really, really well. And are now, this generation, which the past couple of years, the fidelity is really great and the reliability. It's not really a tinkerer's device anymore. It much more just kind of works. There's actually 2 healthcare systems in New Orleans who have now purchased 3D printers because they've been shown the reliability, and they're going to print things like a phone holder for a hospital bed. So this is not something that's reliably easy to attach to a hospital bed or get in the right position without it being some massive gooseneck, whatever. And we've designed a number of them that are one piece 3D printed and kind of just snap onto rails or any shape. We can do any shape. The idea being we'll design them a Hill-Rom compatible phone holder. And then when they have a patient who's in neuro rehab, they can kind of snap it on and the patients have access to their Skype. Right now, the nurses hold the phone.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's actually, it's like, I asked around, it's like, that's how, you know, there's no other thing to do. So I'm really excited for projects like that, because then the hospitals can do it themselves. There's nothing weird about me giving something to then they're giving to their patients and things like that. We're all experimenting. Like, the hospitals are experimenting doing this, and it's taken years of them interacting with Make Good and the other organizations I talked about, seeing universities get involved and seeing results with their own patients on some trial projects for them to get the comfort level. But I think you're going to see a lot more innovation in that field. And I think the focus is really on design work. With the 3D printers now, the real work in doing anything, you know, especially architecture, is the design work itself, is taking the time to think about things and do drawings and do prototypes and testing. Once you have the thing that we've designed and Make Good, to reproduce it is almost inconsequential with the 3D printer technologies. You know, I always put this focus back on the design skills and using those skills, because those are really valuable skills that most people do not have, or even a really strong conception of what it takes or what that really means. So it's incumbent upon us to share that skill with people when we can. And bring out that inner like questioner that's in everyone, you know?
Yeah, because it makes such a profound difference. And your passion is contagious. I see your posts on your LinkedIn. It's always like, look what we designed. And it's often just a very small, very simple device, but it is world changing for the person who receives it. It makes their life easier. It lets them do something they enjoy that they had to stop doing. And that passion is really contagious. I know when we run into each other at conferences, you're always like, look what I have, you know, and you always got some piece of something with you. It goes to this idea of how you do anything is how you do everything. It's not too small, because What I see here that then is so scalable is the way that you hear somebody's story. You don't just take a request and say, let me follow instructions and just find a way to make it work. You are connecting with them as a human being. You are learning their story. And therefore, what you're producing has this infusion of, I don't know if you want to call it love, but a true connection and compassion for that person and what it really means to them to be able to use whatever device you are making. And you make everything at every scale.
Wow, that's very, very, I think, beautifully said. I hadn't really thought about it quite like that. When the Tulane students help, they sign at the bottom of the wheel of the little devices they made, in this case, the toddler mobility trainers. And I do like to think about these objects after they're out and in the world and being used, and the joy they're bringing to people. And everything we try to make is try to be very celebratory and professional and like very high end. We try to do stuff as high end and advanced as possible as well, and really infuse what we do with where the design practice generally is going. It's really amazing hearing everybody's stories who reaches out, and we try to do as many projects as we can. Unfortunately, we can't get to everything either. But what is really neat is when you make one thing like this guitar pick holder we made recently, and we have, you know, a number of people reach out, you know, three or four, who also need the exact same thing. So then it's very easy. You can just print it out and we modify it a little bit if we need and send it. And then you're really making good numbers of kind of getting those devices out there. It's really an alternative way of just launching something commercially, like going to Guitar Center, selling the guitar pick. Because of that, everything can be customized because it's made right there. So, you know, all the guitar picks, we put the names of the recipient on, and there's a lot of like fun you have with it too. And, you know, always building new skills, doing that kind of work, new design work. It's really a great field to get into. And it's, I tell everybody this, it's a nascent field. Like this kind of custom 3D assistive tech is a very young field. There are many people doing it like me out there. Some great friends of mine, and great community of people. But if you're looking for an opportunity to like create innovation and actually like, if you want to launch products or you want to invent something or do research, solve a problem of your own, this is a great field to get into in assistive tech. It's a great time to do it. The technology is just maturing to the point where people like us who have these kind of design skills can now use this high-end manufacturing at scale. And we can use these design tools that are now much easier, and you know, we're used to using them as well. Most of my chairs are drawn in Revit, believe it or not. Kind of getting back to Revit is great for making books. I've seen how all these organizations make assembly guides for their different chairs and whatever. Revit is actually the best tool ever to make a set of instructions, because that's what you're doing when you're doing construction documents. So I've made really great products using Revit that are for assistive tech as well. So it's fun to mix and match all these different things at scale.
Yeah.
You never know where it's going to go. It's impossible to predict when you start working on one of these projects. And I think that's really what drew me in a lot as well. And that's true for anything you do in life.
I can definitely see how your architecture training helps you do this and bring fresh thinking to it. But let's talk about the reverse. How has working, doing assistive technology helped you be a better architect?
It's a great question. I think that problem solving mentality and just exercising that skill. And I think also to an extent, you know, the iterative process and getting just very, very comfortable with it. You know, there are short and sweet architecture projects. There are short and sweet assistive technology projects. There are also 7-year long chair design processes, because that's how on average, how long it should take to design a great chair. And some buildings also is a 7-year long development process. So much of the project management skills and what I've learned, even working with a more diverse group of people doing the Make Good Design projects, given me more ways to communicate, you know, with people who have no exposure to design, no exposure to architecture whatsoever. So that's definitely helped. Kind of those soft skills has helped. But, you know, really that inquisitive mind when I'm investigating a floor plan, you know, getting put on a new project, just, you know, recently put on a large new surgical building. And just being able to read the intent of the design through the plans and through the drawings, and then kind of reverse engineering and saying, what are they trying to solve with? What are we? And then, you know, this is a project I just joined, but you know, that's the question you start with when you start the next project. Like, what's that main problem we're trying to solve with this effort? And really solving that and then kind of going from there. That kind of clarity is very important when you have these big projects that you know are going to take a few years to really see through at the start during this like critical design process. So
yeah,
it certainly helped. And then, you know, obviously just having a better awareness of accessibility in general and universal design in general, clearances and toilet rooms and making sure that like curbless showers really are curbless. And, you know, there are these, all these little things, obviously, that stack up to be an accessible space. A big thing is going way beyond the ADA as far as, you know, some of the clearances and access points and things like this. All codes are compromise, right? Multiple parties came together, had a discussion about what the code should be, an argument, and that's what it ended up being. And the ADA is no different. Pretty well documented, you know, various business owners and, you know, disability groups. It was this, that's how legislation works, but it's a minimum thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's the least you could do. So still see buildings like brand new multi-use apartment complexes just surrounded by stairs. Instead of a ramp, there's one of those little electric lifts that's always breaking. I mean, new buildings like this that planning departments are allowing, and then you're allowed to do that, you know? And I think that's those kinds of things our profession should undertake a better. Yeah.
It's a miss. It's custodial. A missed opportunity.
It's a big missed opportunity for everybody, actually. So yeah, you know, my friend Mark Raymond from Split Second Fitness, he's a wonderful guy. He's in charge of New Orleans Rapid Transit Authority. He's really, really interesting guy. He's a power chair user and he takes elected officials around in wheelchairs around New Orleans downtown. And I mean, we're a special kind of broken sidewalk kind of place in New Orleans, but, you know, it's a really great insight. And if you've never, as an architect, gotten a wheelchair around your own building you've designed, I think you should. And that's something when I'm on site, you know, I have done before and I plan to do again, need to get that understanding and need to talk to people and bring disability advocates and disabled people in the community into the design process. If you design with a community, it's going to be so much better. And this is the same ethos that we use at Make Good and the same ethos that we should be practicing as healthcare architects. It's a big mind project. It's not about one person's vision or one executive's want. It's supposed to be a big collaborative mind project where everyone comes together to make something great for public health, right? And I think that's really what motivates all of us healthcare architects, for sure.
It's an equity issue. When we think we don't need to do this stuff, or we only do what the code makes us do to the minimum standard, or we're not thinking about these little moments that matter, we are really depriving a lot of people of being able to live their best lives. You know, we're shortchanging them, and that's not fair. And we may even be harming them in some cases because of things they won't do because it's too hard to do it or access it.
Then once again, the solutions are simple. When done correctly, it doesn't look like a solution. It just looks like something beautiful, you know? So
right.
That's the real shame about it. It's not like this intractable problem. There's no way around. Like, we are in total control of this entire thing, you know?
Right.
And that's coming back to that responsibility and that awareness and curiosity. I'm always thinking about the people I know, like something like using an elevator. How does somebody who cannot use any of their limbs to push an elevator button, maybe somebody who uses eye gaze to drive their wheelchair with their eyes, how do they call an elevator? And I've seen various people try to design, you know, different kind of button pushers and things. I had some students at Tulane do a really nice prototype. But Otis, maybe you should come up with something. You know, that's kind of how I feel about it. Yeah. It's kind of Schneider. Like, what's going on?
So yeah.
Kind of how I feel about it is that these are solvable problems. You know, I think maybe an elevator that you just stand in front of for 3 seconds and it calls, it might be nice. You know, I might like that instead of pushing some nasty button. So, you know, they need to change their thinking. And don't even get me started on toilets, where, you know, the amount of toilet stuff I've done and research and toilet rooms I've actually drawn. Like, this is once again, this kind of like simple design stuff that goes back hundreds of years that we haven't really changed as a profession, that all really needs to be kind of looked at. You know, elevators is one thing, a little more complicated, you know, but I think there's a way to do it for sure. And I would like to see those companies step up. And, you know, same thing for all the caller and everybody else too. Like they're part of
Yeah.
it, and we're limited sometimes by those
Yeah.
problems. Yeah.
If you're listening, elevator manufacturers, this is your call to action. We want to see some changes here. In addition to asking these better questions of how can I, instead of, well, I guess this only works this way, it is about the network. And that is part of what's helped you be successful on your career path is the alliances you've formed, but also the fact that you have allowed people from all parts of your life to inform all parts of your life. I, in a recent podcast episode, talked about decompartmentalizing. You're not saying, well, my friend who's in a wheelchair isn't an architect, so I don't need to talk to that person. You're bringing them in. That idea of converging things, but also building our network and not being afraid to activate it and putting these calls to action out is important as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can do a lot better job doing that. Projects that do it correctly are they become very popular places. If you're out there listening, you work in like hospitality, especially restaurants, etc. The way people with disabilities like to travel is they have a hotel they really know takes care of them and has the right amount of accessibility. The beds are at the right height, showers they can get into, etc. From there, they find all the different restaurants that are also like that. They're also very accessible. And that's where they go. They're not going to go other places because they're probably not going to be accessible. So there's actually a huge economic discussion here that I guess think it's overlooked a lot. I'm working with UNO, University of New Orleans, on an accessible tourism conference with my friend Mark Raymond, like I mentioned. He actually wants to develop, he says, the world's first fully accessible, every single room hotel. And he wants to make New Orleans like this accessible tourist destination, which I think is a great idea. It's that kind of thinking. And you know, he's my age, he's a younger guy, and I'm seeing more people really connect this idea of kind of improving these environments and not so driven by the owner just want to squeeze money out of something, but it being a real place that enhances life for everybody.
Just giving yourself permission to question the premise a lot of the time and to not just gripe and complain, but to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're an architect out there and you're doing a project that is like you are being squeezed and it is something that it doesn't make you feel comfortable, you should find something else to do. Go work for somebody else or find some other kind of work if you can, because your skills are too valuable, seriously, to do that. People need us to make the world turn and build things and do their businesses and everything else. We're a vital part of society. And so if you can find alignment in that, that's the key, because we are actually really needed and we really do get to help people a lot, you know, a lot of people. But yeah, you have to do it for the right reasons. And we see the projects that do it for the wrong reasons. They get torn down 5 years later because they ultimately didn't work out from an economic perspective. Or if they're in New Orleans, they just collapse while they're building them. It's like this idea of placemaking, I always kind of thought was like this kind of like weird architect concept. Like I was just like, this is just like some black turtleneck talk. But I've been to a few projects that were designed, new design buildings that were very intentional. Community centers, and they actually do make a lot of sense on paper as well. It's like a great investment, and this like community is buoyed, and it's this whole thing. So that's our job to communicate that to the people who have the money. Then that includes the people in the healthcare field. And that's a very difficult thing to do. You know, there's this whole infrastructure of healthcare executives that make a lot of these decisions. We need to work with them and make sure they're understanding the community needs. And we want to be great stewards of their money, right? And you know, use the data that is available to us. This is one of the very interesting areas in AI. I think we're going to see is AI really understanding the world of the development of buildings and how we're using them, and you know, kind of this more strategic planning, especially when it comes to healthcare, because they can use all this data that they have on not only demographics, things like Foresight Digital, which is a digital software that kind of helps understand this scoping idea. Using that kind of predictive modeling, I think is going to be really, really cool for our profession. And then is going to lead to us doing just more interesting projects, right? It's going to
Yeah.
lead to us to doing a building type we might have never thought of that actually is what fits a particular site with a particular community that needs this and needs that sort of thing. So I think that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, there's a lot of freedom when you can get people to overcome their fear of risk. And part of how you do that is showing them how a different way can work.
Yep, absolutely.
Because in the absence of knowledge, it's always easier to say no, because if you do what you know, you get what you know, and people find that acceptable. Even though we all know it's really not. But if you try something different, it doesn't work, you could get fired. So there is that need for us. And I think we need to really embrace that as part of our job to show people how things could work, how a different approach really can be better.
If we don't do that, we get fired anyways, right? Because we go with the first thing they said we should do. And there's going to be some reason it's doesn't make sense, or it's too expensive, or it's going to cost this later. You know, there's always something like that.
Yeah, so exactly. No one respects the waitress, right? And it's not our job to be a waitress filling an order. It's our job to be an informed expert that co-creates and brings innovation to the table.
Oh, that's really interesting. I like this waitress analogy, because I think our job is like selling the seed to the farmer to grow the plants to take them to, you know, like probably like that's where we are actually at. You know, I know some owners are just very difficult. You know, you're not going to argue with somebody or tell them they shouldn't build something somewhere, right? It's not what we're talking about. It's much more about thinking about how we're going to use that data more in the future and make sure that decision making is in the best interest of, you know, your time and this doing this project correctly. And it's done well, it works really well. And those projects where it's done well, folks listening out there, if you're working on a project that feels like a dumpster fire and it's really difficult and you have 1,000 RFIs, that project that was done really well probably also felt like that to the person doing it at the time. So we're all getting through it, you know.
Yeah. It always feels like the hardship was worth it when you see the end result. So when you look at famous people's stories and you hear about what they overcame, it's like, well, of course they did that. But when you're living it and you don't know what's going to happen, it's easy to take the setback as the sign that you should give up.
We have to get used to, and you will, and you know, I did failing and getting stuff wrong in the profession. I will go on record, I guess, saying like I made plenty of mistakes that it probably cost money. I know they did, right? Like things did happen, and I learned from all of those things, and they didn't happen again. I think many architects go through that, and it's kind of part of it, and it's our job to teach and make sure those mistakes are caught before they're put installed and all this kind of stuff. Don't be down on yourself when that happens, because as far as I can tell, it's happened to everybody before you and everyone after you. I'll tell you this, the best piece of advice I could give you is that if you are building an inpatient room, make sure your window is 36 inches above the finished floor maximum and no more. That's a mistake that happened before my time in Washington State that they didn't catch until there was already the whole exterior was framed. Those 3 or 4 inches of it being, you know, at 39 inches cost like $3 or $4 million to fix. And they had to do it. And at that time, that was a CMS rule. It wasn't the building code. It wasn't in the FGI. It was just a CMS thing. But if they wanted those reimbursements, you got to lower the window. So those are the kinds of mistakes that are free to catch early. That's why, you know, being familiar with the building code is really important, because a lot of those mistakes are on a, you know, a certain set of, you know, a few sheets of drawings, and the big ones you can figure out early in a project, right when you get going. It happens throughout projects. And then that's part of our job, is to kind of navigate. And the contractors make mistakes. Owners make mistakes. They change their mind. I mean,
people change stuff in the field without realizing why it was that way. And they don't ask. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we all have the endless catalog of things that we've seen and been through, and it's our job to kind of take it with a smile and figure it out. That problem solving, it's a really fun profession for that reason. I ultimately think that if you want to be an architect, you should be. It's really, I don't think it's that technically burdensome, you know, compared to, I don't know, if you wanted to do something crazy scientific. It's really much more about working with people and understanding 3D space, you know, working with drawings, understanding how to like communicate ideas. I said earlier, contribute to a lot of different parts of your life.
Absolutely. Well, this has been so much fun. I really enjoyed hearing a little more about your origin story and where you're taking things. If people want to connect with you, what is the best way to do that?
Check out Make Good at makegood.design or on Instagram, Make Good NOLA, like New Orleans, Louisiana, NOLA. Connect with me on LinkedIn if you want as well. If you're interested in volunteering for Make Good or those other organizations, Makers Making Change and Tom Global, they're linked on my website and there's a volunteer form on my website as well. If you're interested in kind of getting more involved, if you want to make something or see how we've done it, you can reach out there.
Yeah, build your network. I think that's one of the biggest mistakes architects often make is we can be very insular and we can tell ourselves we're too busy. But the power of networking is you hear somebody else's story, you learn about what's possible or what somebody else has already done. So you don't have to waste your time doing the same thing when it was already there and you could have just used it and built on it.
We're all working in the same world designing stuff. I think we work together, and that's the best part of it.
Yeah, the collaboration over the competition. So, thank you for being so generous with your resources. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on the call today. If you had a great takeaway from this, please share it on Instagram. You can tag me at Architecting Podcast or Noam at Make Good NOLA, or you can tag us on LinkedIn. We love hearing your thoughts and your insights after one of our guests has shared their story. So thanks again so much for being on today.
Thank you again.
For listening. If you want even more content, head on over to architectingpodcast.com and subscribe to my newsletter and get some great free downloads while you're there. Be sure to follow me on social media on Instagram at Architecting Podcast. Facebook and LinkedIn pages are Architecting and the YouTube channel Architecting Podcast. Stay inspired.